Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Policy Committee for January 18th to order. A quorum is present, so we will get started. First item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes. Representative Anderson, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 11th?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I move to approve the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Anderson moves to approve the minutes for January 11, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The minutes are approved. So I'm kind of looking forward to today because we're going to get to hear from a lot of our local folks about what's going on the ground. And so our second item on the agenda is a presentation from the League of Minnesota Cities on the opportunities and challenges that Minnesota's cities face when applying for state and federal infrastructure grants. And members have a copy of their slides in the TV. Oh, you'll have a copy of the slides, sorry. So I'd like to invite Mr. Lightfoot and Ms. Max up to the podium, and if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot, and I serve as one of the intergovernmental relations representatives and manager of federal relations for the League of Minnesota Cities. Jenny Max, who's the city administrator in the city of Nisswa, is testifying remotely this morning, and I'll go through some slides briefly to talk about some of the unique challenges and opportunities that cities, especially smaller cities, have with the IIJA and IRA funding, and some of the potential opportunities for the legislature to help ensure that that small cities can access this funding and have an equitable shot at some of this historic funding that is flowing through the states in the next 5 years. So for some of you that aren't familiar with the League of Minnesota Cities represents the collective interests of 837 member cities across the state of Minnesota. We provide an array of services, including education and training for elected officials, consulting on governance, management, human resources, land use, contracting, workplace safety and codification, of course, legislative representation, which is why you have me here, work comp, property casualty coverage, loss control services, and other services. And throughout the course of the past couple of years, as Congress has passed this historic funding for infrastructure that is flowing through the state, we've been working diligently with our member cities to ensure that they have all the information on the funding available, and of course, working with the legislature and the administration to ensure that that cities have access to this funding. You can go to the next slide, please. So as a part of our advocacy efforts, we really do pride ourselves in being the nonpartisan voice of all Minnesota cities. I think this graph is really important to understand that Minnesota is a small city state. The vast majority of our cities in the state of Minnesota have populations under 5,000. And I want to highlight from this graph that, believe it or not, we learned through the American Rescue Plan Act deliberations and the Coronavirus Relief Fund deliberations that the state of Minnesota has 10% of the entire country's local units of government, given how many cities and how many townships and counties we have in our states, which is great. We have a strong city community in the state. And thus, there are a lot of needs for small cities that we're hopeful that the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and Inflation Reduction Act can assist with. This is particularly important also when we're talking about accessing competitive grant funding. Minnesota being a small city state, when the legislature considers who's applying for these grants, it's not always the Minneapolises and the St. Pauls and the Rochesters and the St. Clouds and the Duluths. It's the Nisswas, it's the North Homes, it's the Stuartvilles and the South Havens as well. And our goal, and hopefully the shared goal of the legislature and the administration, is to ensure that any city, regardless of size or population, has an equitable shot at some of this historic funding. We can go to the next slide, please. So the good news, as this committee has heard and certainly has been discussed in other committees this session already, is the state, as a part of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, is slated to receive billions in historic infrastructure and climate resiliency funding. These two pieces of legislation were nothing short of historic, and the state of Minnesota is slated to receive $7.4 billion over the next 5 years, which is particularly important for cities that have so many infrastructure needs, and we're excited that so many of the new discretionary and formula grant programs available to the states and to cities overlap with so much of what city goals are when it comes to infrastructure. So this funding isn't just for energy and climate and transit. The funding covers things like climate resilience and adaptation, broadband, roads and bridges, water, rail, environment and public lands, airports, and EV charging. And importantly, much of this funding is also available to local units of government as sub-applicants through federal and state discretionary funding. Next slide, please. So in addition to the good news, we have a lot of opportunities. The bad news here is there's a lot of hoops to jump through when it comes to applications for discretionary and formula grant funds. With Minnesota being a small city state, there is also a question of how apt and effective smaller and less resourced cities with the same level of need for funding will be in applying for discretionary grant funding. And with most federal resources through the IIJA and the IRA flowing through federal agencies and through competitive grants, city applicants with less capacity to draft and execute complex resource-intensive projects, areas with smaller populations and smaller tax bases may suffer as localities with higher capacity and resources catch attention of grant administrators at both the federal and the state agency level that are administering these programs. We know that most federal state grant application processes will be propped up for the IIJA and the IRA will require, in many cases, immense pre-application costs and staff, which leads to smaller, less resourced cities that only employ a handful of people oftentimes, leading to some structural disadvantages for less resourced communities. And while we do know that there are technical assistance programs, especially at the federal level for, and even in some cases, state agencies for low capacity jurisdictions, these are usually, as we've heard around the state, insufficient to meet the need, especially in cities that lack the deep bench of staff in engineering departments and other staff that are deployed usually to fill out and submit grant applications at this level. Next slide, please. So when we go around the state, and we do so often to visit our members and meet them where we're at, we've heard a lot of the same things, especially in smaller communities. There's a lot of excitement around this funding. There's a lot of buzz as to the potential for historic infrastructure funding to meet some of the project needs of cities, both large and small, and regardless of population size. If you go to a city like Nisswa or a city like North Home, there are infrastructure needs that can be directly assisted with by the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act funding and the IRA. And some of the common challenges we hear first and foremost, a lack of financial resources to account for pre-application costs. We know that on average, these are estimates from what we've heard from cities, pre-application costs can be incredibly expensive for a city of 4,000 or a city like Nisswa that's under 2,000. Where you have costs anywhere from $8,000 to $25,000 for pre-engineering costs, for data gathering, and for all of the things that go into the submission of a grant application. Some RFPs for federal funding can be hundreds of pages long. And when you have a staff of two or four, a city clerk that's doing 100 million other things, that's also the public works director, that may also be the fire chief, it can be almost overly challenging for some of those cities to access that funding. The other challenge that we hear most often is the lack of bandwidth to put together an application for staff, as I just alluded to. With 70% of Minnesota cities being smaller than 4,000 in population, most cities need outside help to put together an application. These applications can take hours from a limited pool of staff that are pulled in many different directions, and come with it the need for local resources to put together an application that can often make applying for these funding opportunities cost prohibitive for smaller jurisdictions. And thus, most small cities do seek outside help from engineering firms, from other organizations that can help small cities assist with putting together an application. In addition to that, we know that there are over 400 new programs and funding streams that the IIJ authorized, which is awesome and great. It also makes it extremely challenging for small cities to wade through all of those programs to match up a project to a resource and wading through the varying differing application requirements. A lot of this funding is going to flow through state agencies, which will all have different application processes and requirements for cities to apply with. And thus, it can be very challenging for cities to make successful applications when there's just so much available there. Next slide, please. So in assessing that need and in assessing those challenges, the League of Minnesota Cities, in understanding the historic significance of the IIJ funding, created a pilot project called the Grant Navigator Program and put up $500,000 of league resources to help smaller, less resource cities in Minnesota have the access and resources they need to help bridge that resource gap that is often the difference between a city submitting an application or not. We know that $500,000 is going to go very quickly. It is not scalable to meet the vast need of some of our smaller jurisdictions. But we have already seen in its short existence that the need is there. So the program provides $5,000 grants to individual cities in an attempt to help city officials understand, identify, and apply for federal, state, foundation, and nonprofit grants with a focus specifically on cities under 4,000 in population. We've already seen, as I said, a keen interest in cities who will utilize this funding for pre-application costs and help bridge the financial gap to hire outside help to assist limited staff bandwidth in applying and identifying for federal grants. We have tried to limit it to, because of the small amount of resource, to one project per city to maximize opportunity for more cities in our state. And each application for our Grant Navigator grants are reviewed by an internal committee at the League of Minnesota Cities and identified if they are ripe for funding given project parameters and what the city hopes to use the funding for. Next slide, please. So I wanna highlight some of the numbers so far, and I do wanna stress that the program has only existed for a few weeks, but we have already seen a number of applications in terms of based on how long the program has been open. So we've received 8 applications since late December. Our largest city applicant is the city of Stuartville with a population of 6,759. And the small city, the mighty city of South Haven, put together a project proposal with a population of only 187 people, which means they probably have one or two staff that's trying to think about applying for certain levels of funding. And we're very grateful for some assistance at the league level to help them do that. Proposals that we've seen so far have included assistance for both state and federal grants. And we have 3 projects already in the pipeline to receive funding. My colleague, Deputy Director Luke Fisher, who's joining me today, also will be heading on the road to provide some funding for these cities. And hopefully we can get some big checks maybe to have some photo ops. But we're really excited about this program. And I think as you can see through this slide, the based on applications received already and what we're reviewing, it's the smaller organizations and the smaller cities that need the most help. And we're glad to provide a very small piece, hopefully, to unlock some of these opportunities for smaller cities. We can go to the next slide, please. So that said, some legislature considerations, and we've had some conversations with other members in other committees, Representative Acom's committee as well, on what could be the state role in helping assist smaller jurisdictions to make sure that we maximize the IIJA and the IRA funding. First and foremost, we know that our $500,000 is going to go fast. So the consideration for authorizing state funding to assist cities and facing costs and resource barriers to apply for federal grants through state agencies and federal agencies could be an important consideration. We've seen other states do this. The state of Louisiana authorized $5 million of their capital projects funds to assist in this way. Washington State has hired some technical assistance folks in individual agencies to help local units of government. Second, require collaboration between state and local governments to maximize the impact of the IIJA and the IRA. And also encourage state agencies to consolidate grant opportunities, avoid any additional requirements to program applications and streamlining applications as much as possible, while still adhering to federal guidelines, of course. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to turn it over to Jenny Max, the city administrator in the city of Nisswa, to discuss some of the specific unique challenges that a city like Nisswa has with a population under 2,000 in applying for some of these opportunities.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Max. I'm really excited that we were able to have you here. This virtual testimony thing is pretty cool. So please state your record or your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you and good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Jenny Max. And good morning again, Chair Cagle and members of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Committee. I am the city administrator for the city of Nisswa, as well as first vice president of the League of Minnesota Cities. On behalf of the City of Nisswa and the League's 837 members, especially those 700 cities in Minnesota like Nisswa with a population of less than 4,000, I want to thank you for convening this hearing to hear more about the unique challenges of a small city and when it comes to applying for state and federal resources and what the state might consider in terms of assisting smaller, under-resourced cities like Nisswa. It's great to see the committee looking for ways to create opportunities for all of our communities to be successful. For quick reference, Nisswa, as Daniel mentioned, has a population of just under 2,000 year-round residents. We are a tourist destination in the heart of the Brainerd Lakes area that sees tens of thousands of visitors annually. We are 18 square miles in size, 7 of that is water. So our roads and our wastewater infrastructure navigates around 10 large lakes, including a portion of Gull Lake. We have 23 full-time employees, many of which are departments of one that, as Daniel also mentioned, wear a lot of hats. So, for example, our planning and zoning department is a department of one. They answer every phone call. They visit with people that come in with questions from the public, and they write all the reports. They present all of the information that the city council might need. They issue all of the permits, and they do all of the things that encompass planning and zoning. While our city and our staff are small, the infrastructure needs and overall goals of Nisswa are considerable, and we know that through the resources authorized by the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, there will be significant overlap in Nisswa's needs and the resources available to us through the hundreds of new programs that are currently being rolled out through federal and state agencies. However, as I mentioned, with many of our departments being staffed with one person who handles all of the office and administrative work for those departments' activities, it's very difficult for Nisswa to compete in many of these grant programs that could help us achieve our long-range infrastructure and sustainability goals. So, for example, the City of Nisswa, in partnership with the City of Lakeshore, a city just to the west of us, we've been working towards completion of the Gull Lake Trail, which is a regionally significant multi-use trail that's 21 miles long and travels through four municipalities, and it ends at Nisswa Lake Park in the heart of Nisswa's downtown area. Part of making this trail project happen was seeking out funding through both state and federal programs, which required pre-engineering work that included surveying, preliminary trail design to determine the optimal route and avoiding unnecessary design complexities, and details about any necessary or potential property acquisition, to name a few items. These application questions were well beyond the scope of what city staff could determine in-house, and they required the city to pay for an outside consultant, our city engineer in this case, to perform work to generate this data that we could use to complete the grant applications. So for our trail project, NISWA spent over $12,000 in pre-engineering costs over a two-year period before the city council even officially gave the project the green light to proceed. On top of that, we then officially contracted with a grant writer to help us to complete those grant applications, mostly for the state-specific one, but also for some federal grant application assistance as well. But that was above and beyond the $12,000 that we had spent initially for that pre-engineering work. The trail project has taken the better part of 5 years. We anticipate going to construction hopefully this spring, so cross your fingers for us. And it has become very taxing on staff when we have to navigate the complexity of archaeological studies, environmental impact reports, wetland delineations, et cetera. And the time it takes and just that compounding resources becomes very difficult for us to work through as a small community. As Daniel mentioned, cities like NISWA are extremely grateful for the League's Grant Navigator program, which will allow less resource cities an opportunity to bridge the financial gap to cover those pre-application costs, which can often make the difference in a small city applying for a grant or not. It's really that initial hurdle that can become so difficult to overcome. It's just a daunting task to even figure out how can we do that as a community to make that work. For our trail project, it was important for our city to work towards making that final completion because it is a regionally significant project, and we wanted to work with other communities to bring that to completion. We'd welcome additional state involvement in the form of a state competitiveness fund that could provide cities seeking to apply for grants with the state resources to offset pre-application costs and assure our state has maximum uptake of these new federal funding opportunities, regardless of how big or small a city is. As I've looked through some of the funding programs, it seems like a lot of them are available to larger communities, likely to maximize the return on those dollars. But a community like NISWA, we see tens of thousands of visitors to our city, even though we have a small year-round population, and we have a lot of the same needs that a larger city does. So having the opportunity to access those dollars is really important for us. Lastly, we encourage the legislature and state agencies to provide adequate technical assistance in each of the grant areas to assist city staff as they develop projects and seek grant funding in order to make the grant application process as easy as possible while still adhering to federal guidelines. Wherever we can streamline and simplify while still obtaining the necessary information would be appreciated. But thank you again, Chair Cagle and members, for the opportunity to testify this morning and for your attention to the unique challenges of small cities as the rollout of funding opportunities from these new programs continue. And I'm happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so we will move to member questions. And I'm going to take the first one with Mr. Lightfoot. Why didn't you tell us it was your birthday? Happy birthday.
Well, Madam Chair, members, thank you for acknowledging that. Today is my birthday, and I wouldn't spend it any other way than being here with you all this morning talking about an important issue. So thank you for acknowledging that. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for both presentations here. Just a couple of questions. I see Mr. Johnson over there from the League, and this is reminding me of a bill I had a while back, I think over 10 years ago, where we asked local cities to incorporate climate change and land use plans. And I think Mr. Johnson, at the time, correctly pointed out, I've had some opportunity over about 12 years to reflect on this or more, pointed out the lack of resources. That if we wanted you to do comprehensive plans that incorporated climate change, and of course that is a very key part of addressing climate change, particularly in the transportation sector, which I pay attention to, you needed the resources. And that's kind of why that bill wasn't enacted in part. And so here we are again, and that's why I strongly support this initiative that you're talking about here, Madam Chair, and in terms of you being able to, use the resources to get these grants. So two questions. One is, you talked about the initial success of the Grant Navigator. What do you need? Do you have a range? Is there a dollar figure that people like Ms. Max might need to be able to fully avail themselves of these opportunities? Do we know what resources are required? Because I'm certainly willing to step up as a state. I think it is our responsibility. I support this initiative. But what are we talking about?
Yeah,
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, I appreciate that question. We certainly wrestled with that question in terms of what would it look like in terms of the provision of grants to individual cities and having a limited amount of resource at the league. We've kind of thought about what are the average costs for pre-engineering, and what we found is generally in that $5,000 to $25,000 range per individual grant was kind of the sweet spot. Given that we only had $500,000 to work with, we kind of went on the low side of that to try to spread out the resource as much as possible. I think it the need is great. I don't know if I have a particular appropriation number in mind. I know we are operating with a fairly significant budget surplus, and in terms of utilizing one-time funding of that surplus, we believe the best ways to do that are leveraging those resources for non-state resources at the federal level. So I would be certainly looking forward to working with you and the committee to figure out what does that number look like. I think if you factor in the 700 or so cities with populations under 4,000, knowing that the need is great, I think we could utilize a fairly significant appropriation of one-time funding to assess those needs.
Chair Hornstein?
Thank you. I look forward to those conversations. And then, because I think that we would have the conversation here, and it would probably end up in transportation finance. But the second question I have is, sort of back to that example I mentioned earlier. Is there anything in the IIJA or any recent federal legislation related to climate that would assist you in better incorporating climate issues in your local comprehensive planning and zoning process? Is there anything in the legislation that, in terms of criteria that you could apply for specifically for that purpose?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, the short answer is yes. The Inflation Reduction Act really focused on less so in terms of federal funding for programs and more so on the tax credit front. The good news for cities is the ability now for entities like local units of government that don't pay that are non-tax entities to take advantage of some of those tax credits through a new program called a direct pay option. So in that sense, you could have the situation where a city would take advantage of a tax credit to do things like a solar array or to invest in a clean commercial vehicle. On the IIJA side, there are a number of significant programs that focus on climate change, that focus on carbon reduction, that do focus on sustainable infrastructure. We can certainly follow up with a list of all of those programs. But the short answer is there are significant opportunities for especially smaller cities that in some cases have wanted to embark on some of those projects to address sustainability and climate change, but haven't necessarily had the resources to do so because their water treatment plant needs upgrading or their road infrastructure needs upgrading. So we can certainly get you a full list of those programs that would avail cities of that opportunity.
Chair Hornstein.
I appreciate that, and a very quick follow-up, and we certainly can talk about this as the session evolves. But back to that bill that I referenced with Mr. Johnson, are there resources available if a city wanted to, a small city or a city that doesn't have resources, you know, like I think some of our larger metro cities have a climate action plan or something approaching that. Would you be able to access federal funds for something like that under either the IRA or IIJA?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, I believe the answer is yes. I would have to look at a couple of separate programs to determine the specific eligible projects, eligible activities that a city could embark on in accessing those funds and utilizing those funds. But I'm thinking of the PROTECT program, and there are a couple of other federal programs that were newly authorized by the IIJA that that seek to help with planning for a different climate, planning for how cities can upgrade their infrastructure to be climate resilient. And so I'll take a look again and get you some information on some specific programs as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to both of our presenters. As a Southern Minnesota representative, I really appreciate the work you guys are doing. And although my city, Rochester, is certainly not a small city, we have a lot of great small communities around us, including Stuartville, which was mentioned up there. So thank you for that. You mentioned two current grant programs that states are in. If I am correct, it's Louisiana and Washington, the two you named. Do you have more specifics about the parameters of those particular ones? Or if you don't have the specifics now, if we could receive those just to kind of see what those states specifically are doing.
Mr. Lightfoot?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. So the program in Washington State is run through several of their state agencies, and they appropriated funding to hire FTEs in some of their state agencies, specifically in a role of assisting city applicants of this federal funding through the agencies with completing a grant application. We've seen some state agencies in Minnesota be interested in this in terms of hiring on more technical assistance. We know that agencies will be creating, in many cases, brand new grant processes that are new to all sub-applicants. The Louisiana program is sort of more similar to what we are doing at the League in the sense that the state, through the use of their American Rescue Plan Act dollars, appropriated funding for essentially the type of purpose that we're talking about now, which is small grants to help defray pre-application costs for, in their cases, parishes, to apply for some of this funding. And I can certainly work with my colleagues at the Louisiana Municipal League and get you some more, get the committee more specific information on program parameters, successes, potentially what this committee and the legislature could learn from some of what they're doing in Louisiana.
Can I have one more question?
Real quick.
Sorry. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, when we talk about small cities, it's hard to define exactly what that means. I'm curious if you find a strong cutoff at that 5,000 population limit where they can't get money from the gas tax we know because of our Constitution. Do you find that that is a big, as we think about how to fund these better, is that 5,000 population a really strong limit on cities that can apply for these grants versus those who might need help from us and institutions like yours?
Mr. Lightfoot?
Madam Chair, Representative, state statute in many places uses the 5,000 population as a cutoff for defining small cities. My colleague, you'll hear from my colleague, Cap O'Rourke, who represents only small cities, and he may have a better sense of that. But I don't think there's a hard and fast cutoff at 5,000. You know, we've seen cities with populations of 6,000 or 8,000 still have some of the similar needs. Given our program and the amount of funding that we had available, we wanted to focus on the cities that that are the smallest and in our minds have the greatest needs when it comes to this type of program. But I think I don't know if I would say that there's a hard and fast cutoff. I'm sure in defining, you know, what we would be utilizing a potential state program with, we'd have to figure out, you know, what is that cutoff. And generally speaking, the smaller cities are 5,000 and below in population, where you sort of get the small staff, the less resources, et cetera.
Thank you.
So we have Representative Anderson and then three more on the list, and then we will move on to the next.
I'll be quick, Madam, sure. Madam Chair. You mentioned the $7.4 billion in the IIJA. How much of that is coming to Minnesota, and has that money actually been allocated? And then just a quick follow-up, you can do them both at the same time. In your opinion, is the application process for these two big, huge programs going to be more complicated than previous federal grants, or is it just because of the size of the money coming that there's this awakening of being able to apply for grants, or will it be a tougher application process?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for the question. To your first question, the $7.4 billion is the state's allocation from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. That is a combination of both existing formula funding programs, primarily through the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the Public Facilities Authority, et cetera, for boosts in existing programs. But a significant part of that is in the form of new programs that will be run through state agencies. Most of those programs have a period of time lasting over 5 years, so that isn't just 1 year. Most of those programs have funding allocations from the federal government over a period of 5 years. In terms of the application process, it's hard to say. I think if you asked any small city, what do you think about the federal grant application process or the, in some cases, the state agency process? It can be a little daunting. So I don't know if I would have an opinion on sort of if those applications are going to be more or less challenging. I think the good news is some of that application process through state agencies will be run through existing processes. For example, the Public Facilities Authority's state revolving funds for water, for clean water and drinking water, that's being run through an existing process. However, those challenges of pre-application, pre-engineering still remain in those programs. And so in terms of the new creation of some of those state agency grant applications, it sort of remains to be seen. That's why we're encouraging the agencies and the legislature to make sure that to the best extent practicable, we can make that process as easy as possible for our smaller, less resourced cities.
Representative Gilman.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much, Mr. Lightfoot and Ms. Max. My question is, in the application process, is the $5,000, grant that's available, it sounded like she paid out of pocket, they paid above and beyond for a grant writer. Did the $5,000 towards the grant navigator go towards their grant writer expenses, or is that two separate processes?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, thanks for the question. In the case of NISWA's application for the Gully Trail that Ms. Max mentioned, that was a project that wasn't funded by the Grant Navigator program. However, in the applications that we've received, we've seen a variety of applications in terms of what a city wants to use that $5,000 for. We have seen a couple of applications take that $5,000 and add some city resources to retain outside assistance, either from a grant writer or from a outside engineer to help with pre-engineering. However, as Ms. Max noted, $5,000 is not enough to cover those costs. So we're hopeful that our $5,000 can help defray some of that cost, but not potentially cover it. But we have seen cities apply to that program for assistance with that $5,000 to help, again, defray some of the ultimate overall costs that a city would utilize to retain outside help in that sense. So it wouldn't be two separate processes. In that case, it would be just the $5,000 helping that city address some of those financial needs for outside assistance.
Representative Gilman?
Okay, so just one little follow-up then. So from my understanding then, the Grant Navigator is not a duplicable system where people can just put in their info and it helps support them through the grant writing process. It's not like a system built for that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Representative Gilman, I understand what you're saying. I think what it is it's a cash award, basically, where they can then hire the help that they need. But I think what you're thinking of would be really cool.
I'm like, make,
Yeah, Madam Chair. Representative Gilman, correct.
Take that That's back. Correct. Don't pretend you didn't hear that. No. No, I just was like, can you, like, you know, code it, make a really cool system, and let anybody use it.
Are you a computer geek?
No.
All right. Any other follow-up questions at all, Representative Gilman?
No, thank you. Thanks
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this really important session here, especially coming from city government recently and also having done a bunch of organizing of city elected officials from all around the state, including folks from as far, you know, the field is Moorhead, Grand Rapids, Grand Marais, Red Wing, Rochester, as well as St. Louis Park and other metro areas. This issue is one that I heard repeatedly of how to approach this. And my questions are a couple things. One is, I really appreciate you guys getting something out there and trying to do something and trying to help. One of the challenges that I also have heard about was sometimes it's hard to know even where to start, what to ask for. So how do you deal with that for cities when, okay, there's this $5,000 out there, but I don't even know what to ask for? And I'll throw a couple other things to tie into that. And then beyond that, with grants, there's also, okay, how do we implement it and then how to report on it? So what are your thoughts regarding the full grant process?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, thank you for your question. Thank you for your service in local government. We appreciate it. In terms of the identification of grants, you're absolutely right. It can be one of the most challenging, and we've seen some good examples in state agencies where a city will have a project. I'm thinking of the PFA's IUP process, the intended use plan process, where a city will have a project and sort of throw it out there. And they have staff and technical assistants that can help identify funding streams that could overlap with a particular project. When we think about technical assistance, I think that's a really important component. In terms of our Grant Navigator program, we have seen applications, at least in the small batch that we've received since the program's inception, to use some of that $5,000 resource to retain outside help to help a city identify some of those grant opportunities. They have a list of capital improvement projects that they're seeking to do in the coming years, and outside help can help identify some of those opportunities. We at the League try our best to put out as much information about grant opportunities as possible, and as do the state agencies. But you are absolutely right that it can be incredibly challenging when there's so much information available.
Representative Kraft.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. One brief follow-up, Mr. Lightfoot. So it strikes me, and I wanted to see if you would agree with this, that there's maybe there's some economies of scale in this for a more centralized function where once you learn, you can share with other cities and almost be proactive about, hey, here's something that these 20 cities could actually apply for, and here's maybe some sample language that Representative Gilman creates in her tool that we just talked about. But that there's a level of sharing and proactivity that can reduce those barriers.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, absolutely. I think the information sharing is important, and we worked very closely with the National League of Cities for one of their pilot programs that essentially did just that, would help Minnesota cities sort of do some of the data gathering with a grant that the NLC received from a foundation to help cities sort of in a cohort gather data, apply for similar grant programs, learn from each other, and we're committed to continuing to do a lot of that information sharing at a league level, and certainly would welcome any opportunity to work with this committee and the legislature on formalizing something that, like that at a larger scale, because I think that information sharing piece is really important as well.
Thank you.
Representative Kraft? Good. All right, I think that's the list. So thank you guys so much. Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. And if we could get Cap O'Rourke up to
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we're all kind of heading in the same direction here, so this is really cool. Welcome to the committee, Mr. O'Rourke. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cap O'Rourke. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We represent the over 700 cities that have populations under 5,000 across the state of Minnesota. We have member cities in every congressional district. I think a lot of times people think that small cities only exist in greater Minnesota, and the reality is we have over 50 small cities that are in the Twin Cities metro area as well.
Hilltop?
As Chair Cagle knows, she just got a new small city in her district. We work very closely with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we are very appreciative of their Grant Navigator program that they recently rolled out. We have been promoting it to our members. I think one thing to understand with IIJA, it was drafted in Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., a small city is defined as either 20,000 or 50,000, depending on the type of agency. So the notion of how it's going to filter down and reach our cities with populations under 5,000 is really somewhat of a difficult challenge that a lot of our cities apply for or are facing. Not only do many of our cities have small staff, as Daniel mentioned, you know, we have staffs of two or three, and they are often doing many, many jobs, whether it's being the clerk, being taking in public utility payments, managing a municipal and liquor store. These people are doing many jobs, and we often would joke when we would fly out to D.C., we hope it doesn't snow because one of our board members is also in charge of plowing the streets. So that was, and that is true. And so when we talk about access to IIJA money, the reality is grants are great, or assisting with grant applications is really good, and it's useful, and we want to continue to do it, both at the state and federal level. But the reality is we have huge needs for infrastructure, as Chair Hornstein knows. We have no ongoing and dedicated funding for our streets. We also have huge needs coming up in our wastewater. And if we want to get some of these monies to cities under 5,000, the reality is the state is going to have to help focus and direct those, not simply make it easier to apply, because even though we have access to applying, the reality is many of our cities are just, even with the $5,000 from the league, even through an application, many of our cities will not see money come their way. We are going to have to, the state is going to have to make some of these small cities more of a priority, and they're going to have to create additional programs that help funnel. We get ongoing funding for our roads and our wastewater and make sure that our broadband is taken care of. These are our three big infrastructure needs. But as far as just relying on access to IIJA, that is going to be a real steep hill, and I don't think you will see a significant number of cities, even, and especially with the concerns that Chair Hornstein raised about the climate, I don't think you will see a significant number of cities truly be able to take advantage of these programs the way that many are hoping and had intended.
Wonderful. Any questions for Mr. O'Rourke? Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. So next we'll move on to city and county staff. So first up is Joe McPherson, who is our county engineer from Anoka County, somebody that I've worked pretty close with. And apparently all the county engineers are at a conference up in at Craigens, so they're all having fun at the lake. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McPherson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Joe McPherson. I'm the Anoka County Engineer and Transportation Division Manager. And you guys have heard a lot of great testimony this morning. You know, as I sat down preparing for my testimony today, I started running through the lessons learned over the course of the last couple of years, submitting applications through the IIJA, or the IRA, funding opportunities. And so the great opportunities,
Mr.
But as
McPherson,
you've heard before
can I,
me.
Can I pause for a second? I'm sorry. I wanted to let everybody know I invited Mr. McPherson here because they recently applied for one of the mega grants through IIJA for the Highway 65 project. And so I wanted him to kind of share what our county went through when applying for this grant. So sorry for the interruption, just kind of wanted to preface that. So continue, thank you.
No problem, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so as I mentioned, as I was preparing for this testimony, I wanted to share some bullet points and some lessons learned on our part as we went through this grant cycle. And so focusing in on this, the mega grant application, we were fortunate through the IIJA bill that the infra and the mega grant opportunities, they're both large grant opportunities, over $1 billion available on both of those. You were able to submit one application, and it was like checking the box for both grant applications. So that was great. It saved us time and money, but it was still a $30,000 venture for us. So I prepared a list of items here that I thought I would share with the committee here. As you're working with your local agencies, your local reps, you're going to probably receive a lot of questions because there's a lot of buzz going around about both these funding opportunities. So I thought I'd share these with you. So first and foremost, project eligibility. As we started looking at our Trunk Highway 65 project in the city of Blaine, a number of things came up. First off, there's a plethora of different funding opportunities. Which ones are right for your project? So it's not as easy as just saying, well, let's apply for all 17 that say transportation. It's a lot deeper than that. As you see with a lot of federal programs and funding opportunities, there's strings attached. It's more than one element to that project that they're looking for. So first and foremost, make sure that you have a rock solid project description that really spells out what your improvements are, what you're planning to do, the location of those, and then include any multimodal innovative project approaches, whether it's carbon reduction, if you're looking at transit oriented developments, also underserved communities. A lot of the funding opportunities talk about those things and they're major buzzwords. Also, as you look into it, another element that's very important is where are you at with the project? Is this something that you dreamt up overnight because you saw funding eligibility? Or is this something that your community and your region has been working on for a number of years? In our case on 65, it's been a major joint effort all the way from our local city partners through the county, MnDOT, FHWA, and our very helpful elected officials, both at the city, county, state and federal levels. And so all of that makes a big difference in what you're doing. Also your project readiness. If you receive the money, so let's say you ask for $50 million, if you receive a portion of that, are you ready to hit the ground running? That is a question that comes up in a lot of those grant applications. And it's a reality for agencies when they submit this, because not only are you asking for money, but you're, in a way, you're really, in some cases, painting yourself back into a corner. If you're asking, let's say you have a $100 million project, for instance, you're asking for $75 million. You get $50 million of it. If your delta on that project, the funding, is now $50 million, you need to find it. And there's a time clock ticking on that. So that's another thing you got to take into account. And then do you have data for crash data, travel time savings, carbon reduction, all of that? That's something you need to come to the table with, because in your application, they want to see a description and an analysis performed in there. And they want to see that included. The next category is project support, and this is a big one. We were actually questioned as the FHWA team that was reviewing our application was going through it. What kind of support do you have for the project from your project partners? Do you have the Chamber of Commerce or Chamber of Commerce's on board if it's a big regional project? Are your congressional members on board with this project? Area businesses, community groups, if you have underserved community groups that have a strong local voice, it's key to include them in there, and letters of support go a long way. Then in any other key stakeholders, if you got watershed districts, those types of things. And then project cost, of course, like I mentioned, what level of cost estimates are available? Is it planning level? Is it a more detailed engineering level cost estimate where you have some of those risks analyzed already and you really narrowed it down and your contingencies are lower? Or is this a big ask and you have a 10 to 20% contingency on that number? And then what does your current funding gap look like? So as you heard some of our local counterparts at the city level talking about, you know, gathering funding to complete the applications is step one. Then, but then also, if you submit for the funding, on the backside of that, you know, you may only receive 40% of what you're looking for. You've got to make up that other gap. And then, again, applications don't typically provide 100% of what you ask for. In our experience, we received an infra grant award back in 2020 on Highway 10. We had asked for approximately $65 million. We were very fortunate. I was very happy. We got $40 million of it. But again, that's a $25 million delta that you need to make up. And then I would say, I don't want to repeat what other presenters have put forward today, but application hurdles, one of the biggest elements that's out there that you really need to be aware of is the benefit cost analysis, which is a very difficult and very technical analysis process that you need to go through. We at the county, we hired that out. Although we have a lot of technical staff, that's a very difficult analysis. You got to have the right software, so you need to reach out and you need to have a consultant team on board to help you out with that. And that's just part of the application process. I'm not even talking about design here. And then also cost for the application can be a hurdle. As noted earlier by previous presenters, that can be a major hurdle. So I'd open it up to questions, though. I really just want to give you a snapshot of things that we've run into, lessons learned, and where we're going to try and improve on our next applications.
Thank you, Mr. McPherson. And I know we're still waiting to hear about that Highway 65 grant. I keep joking that until that grant comes through, whenever Joe calls me, I'm answering that call real quick. So any member questions for Mr. McPherson? None? All right. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Next, we have Mr. Matt Poharski. Oh, I sure hope I got that right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. It's Matt Poharski, so it's not an easy one to say, but I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to the committee on behalf of some of the grants that we've received at the City of Chaska. We have been very fortunate. A couple of recent projects that we have received dollars from both state and federal sources. One is a full reconstruct of Highway 41 through downtown Chaska. Another one is the installation of sewer infrastructure to be able to get up to a new industrial park that will create about 5,000 jobs when it's all said and done. And we've been very fortunate to get this. But I think, you know, some of the things that people have talked about before certainly were barriers in that process. You know, I think first and foremost, I think the lesson that we've learned over time with the dollars that we've received is that it costs a lot of money to be able to successfully apply for these grants. City of Chaska, we do not have a large staff. We only have a couple of people on our engineering staff to be able to work on this. And some of the specific details that are needed for these grant applications are just not are not specialties that we have on staff. And so we end up having to go out and hire contract engineers to be able to do all of the analysis that's necessary to be successful in those grant processes, and then to also help with the actual grant application narrative process. You know, primarily because it's a very complicated process to navigate. I think the other thing that really has stood out to us is, you know, a lot of these projects, you know, Highway 41 and the sewer project are projects that you end up having to cobble together a number of different funding sources. And one of the challenges when you have that is each funding source has its own list of things that you can do and what you can't do. And so the administrative burden of trying to figure out, you know, what can you use these dollars for, what can't you use them for, how do you make the project work so that you meet the rules of the different programs that are out there, adds a level of complexity that certainly increases the cost of the project. You know, it certainly would be, I think, a benefit to look at, you know, how do you create consistency amongst funding sources as far as the rules, the procedures, what's expected? You know, because when you have different funding sources that you know have different levels of you know things that they need to see as far as information or requirements. It just adds a little level of complexity that we just don't have people on staff to be able to monitor that. So even as we get into administering the projects themselves, the projects become much more expensive than if we would just have a have no grant dollars going into them. So I think that that's sort of a cautionary tale that we've had. I think some of the challenges that we've run into too, especially in a third ring suburb, is just how programs are set up that oftentimes are really going towards areas that might have a higher density. There might be different goals that the programs have that make them much more applicable to places closer to Minneapolis and St. Paul, which becomes really difficult because especially when we're talking about putting in infrastructure to help create jobs, you know, this is where there's still land to be able to create those jobs. But a lot of times, you know, we go through the process and find that it's just not geared for communities that are in a third ring suburban sort of setting. Sometimes we find that, you know, there's programs that are specifically for small cities, specifically for more of the central cities, and we sort of sometimes fall right in the center that makes it really difficult for us to be able to get access to those funds. I think the flexibility on how the dollars can be used, I think is a big issue, especially when you have multiple different funding sources that are coming in, and each one might have a specific thing that they need the dollars to go to. That can really make it cumbersome as far as the administrative side of things. And then I guess I'd just say that overall, it's to me, it's the complexity of these processes that often makes communities just not choose to go down the road of actually seeking these funds to begin with, which I think is a shame because, these are very useful for us to be able to accomplish goals. I think really do have a regional and statewide impact. But when you have local government units that, just don't have that expertise on staff to do things, you're really sort of taking a financial risk when you go out to try to get these dollars, because if you're spending $30,000-$40,000 on a consulting engineer to be able to put these grant applications and you don't receive the dollars, that's a large investment that the community is making without any return. We're very fortunate here in Carver County to have Carver County and Lyndon Robgent, who is going to be testifying later, that we've been able to partner up on some of those technical aspects. But it is a challenge, and it definitely is a barrier to communities applying for these dollars. So I certainly would be happy to answer any questions, but really appreciate the opportunity to share our experience.
Thank you so much. Are there any member questions? Not seeing any. So thank you, Mr. Poharatsky.
You're right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You. Next up, this is another one, huh? Ms. Lori Hokkanen, City Administrator of Chanhassen.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. Lori Hokkanen, City Manager in Chanhassen. Thank you to Representative Ream for asking us to share our experience. After conferring with the team here in Chanhassen, we had four points that we wanted to share with the committee. All of them are repetitive of what you've heard this morning, but I'm hoping that will be reinforcing as well. First is the barrier to entry is significant. I would call us a medium-sized city at 25,000. We do not have a dedicated grant writer, and most of our staff is focused on day-to-day operations. So when we choose to apply for a grant, we need to take time away from another project or bring in a consultant. We are applying for some DNR park funds this summer. We're very excited about that opportunity. But as context, we will be spending about $30,000 for a consultant engineer to help us prepare for that application to increase our chances of success. Oftentimes, number two is that we feel like we won't qualify for grant funds, so we choose not to make that investment. Sometimes the grant will technically look like we would qualify, but as we receive feedback from staff or administrators of the program, we're told that because of our higher than average income or our lack of diversity, it's unlikely that we'll actually apply for the program. And so we choose not to pursue those opportunities. Number three is the benefit versus the cost of compliance. We recently explored a grant through a watershed district that would have required us to report annually for 10 years. And when we looked at the number of metrics that we would need to track, we agreed with the idea of what was trying to be done, but ultimately we felt like the cost of providing that over the 10-year long period would outweigh what we would actually receive up front. So we chose not to pursue that opportunity. So I would just encourage anyone who's designing a grant program to consider if the measures are going to undercut people wanting to pursue the opportunity. And then finally, we also talked about cities are generally fiscally conservative and risk averse, and particularly when there are grant programs that can allow us to try out new technology or techniques. That, first of all, can be really helpful in overcoming that particular barrier that cities can be very risk averse. But just making sure that the program allows for kind of an iterative process if you're trying something new so that you can actually be successful. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Any member questions? Seeing none, then we will move on to Mr. Robigent. Man, you guys are just throwing me for a loop this morning. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, good morning, Madam Chair. Lyndon Robigent. I'm the Carver County Engineer. With Joe up at the Cragans Conference, forgive me, I've got a little bit of a cold this morning, but I wanted to share with the committee our story on Highway 212. I think what's common to everybody this morning is you can see that the locals are really stepping up on these regional projects or state significant projects in our state and going after these grants. I can't emphasize that enough. I have a pretty small staff, too. I mean, we are a metro county. Our funding is pretty good, but we do have a small staff. But, you know, my board told me 13 years ago when I came to the county that we've got to fix Highway 212 in our county. You know, that's not our road. That's a MnDOT highway. So it's been our mission ever since to do that. So if I could, Madam Chair, I have a few slides to share our story on our project. So if I could share my screen, that would be.
And members, you should have these in your packet as well.
Okay, let's see if we can do this.
We're working on trying to get you screen sharing ability.
Can you see that? All right, can you see my screen, Madam Chair?
No, hold on one moment. We have the presentation, so if you want to just let us know when to advance the slides.
Okay. All right, great. Yeah, we're up at Cragen, so hopefully the internet is okay. But so we applied for a infra grant for Highway 212 in Carver County. And again, this is a long process, and I think lessons learned here is there's a lot of money out there, and the money has increased with IIJA, but it's highly competitive. These projects have to be very well planned. You have to do a lot of work up front before you even think of applying for a grant. So, you know, we have two lane gaps in rural Carver County on Highway 212. This is a regional freight corridor that goes all the way to South Dakota. So it's been a mission of the county to try to improve this road for many, many years. mainly because of the high freight traffic and the crash history that we've had over the years on a two-lane rural highway that was built 95 years ago. So what we do, you know, obviously you have to have somebody on staff, whether it's myself or a planner. We happen to have a pretty good planning staff, but it takes time. It takes about 3 months to process a new application. And if you want to do it again, which I'll tell you a little later on how we succeeded on this one, you know, it takes a couple months to do a resubmittal. It's about 80 to 100 hours of staff time, or 10 hours per week, over a two-month period. You like Joe said, you have to have a consultant. I mean, a lot of the small agencies don't have people on staff that can do the technical analysis. It's extremely complicated. So I think Joe mentioned it too, it's about $30,000 per application. So if you don't have that technical expertise on staff, you've got to hire a consultant to do that. So if there's a way the state can help us with that, to have somebody that can do like the benefit cost analysis, which is extremely complex, that's something that would probably help the applicants. You've got to have a good application, a really good story. Professional graphics are really huge. We learned over time with coordinating with the federal DOT that, you know, they've got multiple scorers on these applications. So you've got to tell a story in a complex way, but keep it simple because there's multiple people looking at the application. So you have to tell your story in a simple way because they might split up the documents and give them to several different people to score. You've got to look at the criteria that address the application. You know, for the infra grant, you know, it's about freight, it's about expanding access to rural folks and opportunities for employment. Obviously, safety is a huge one. I think the nation as well as Minnesota, the safety issues are a must right now. And we have so much aging infrastructure that we're at a critical time where we have to do something. And then, of course, sustainability and equity with climate change. You've got to have an application that builds a road or a bridge for 20 to 50 to 100 years. So, again, like Joe mentioned, the funding process, I mean, it took us 12 years to be successful. And you can see on the pie chart here the amount of different grants that we applied for. We did a freight grant through the MnDOT DOT here. We happened to get $7 million out of that. We applied through the regional solicitation through the MEC Council, $3.5 million. We applied for earmarks through the Congress. We got two different earmarks, for one for $2 million, one for $4.5 million. We eventually got which we're very thankful for. The legislature did a bonding program for Trunk Highway 212, and one for design and one for construction for $25 million. And then we got MnDOT. Remember, this is a U.S. Trunk Highway. MnDOT came to the table with $6 million. And then the county adopted the local option sales tax in 2017. And I can say that was really a game changer for us because you got to commit to local funding when you get these grants. You can't just rely on outside sources only. So it's a journey, a long journey. And we still have a shortfall now. And that's mainly, you know, when we applied for the grant, you have to commit that you'll have full funding when you're done. At the time we did. But now we're looking at a shortfall because, as you know, Madam Chair, the inflation rates have averaged 8% per year over the last 5 years. So although we at the time of the grant, we look like we're in good shape, we're predicting that we're going to be $6 million short. So actually we'll be submitting a state request through the legislature for our shortfall. So, you know, we prepare materials. We did an informational video, not only for the grant application, but for the public. We have a coalition, the Southwest Corridor Transportation Coalition, that's made up of local governments from Minneapolis all the way to the South Dakota border. You've got to get letters of support from your legislature and from the neighboring cities and counties, and get legislative support from your delegation, not only at the state level, but also your congressional delegation in D.C. And we found that having a lobbyist, although It's another expense that you have to do. You have to have somebody in D.C. as well as Minnesota that can support your project and meet with the right staff at the right time during the process. Because you got to remember one thing about these projects is they might be a local priority and very important to your community, but they may not be a MnDOT priority. And so there are the applications are extremely competitive. Even though there's a lot of money out there, there's a lot of people asking for it. So you can see our story, which I think is a pretty good one. We applied 12 times for a discretionary grant, whether it was Infra, Fastlane, Tiger, Build, Raise, and we scored very well. So the application process got better and better, but eventually we got a $10 million Infra grant. But it's a journey. It's not like you can just come up with a project and you'll get it the first time. That just doesn't happen. One thing that was really successful for us is getting the feedback from the US DOT on these discretionary grants. They're there to help. They will do interviews with you after or even during your application process and tell you what you should do to have a better application. But the lesson learned is it's a really arduous process, but it's worth it in the long run, and you just have to stick at it. And again, the county took 12 years to get one grant, so it's quite a journey. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you so much. We'll move to member questions. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Robjant, for testifying today, as well as Ms. Hokanen and Mr. Podrowski. I do think the third ring suburbs have a unique situation, and it's good to see Carver County being an area that is thinking about sustainability, thinking about equity. I know, like you said, sometimes we don't qualify for grants because our incomes are high and our diversity is low. But I think Carver County and these growing areas, Scott County is also, it's either Carver County or Scott County when they say the fastest growing county in Minnesota. But I think these are areas where we have a great opportunity to build sustainable infrastructure, to have that balance of transportation that includes public transportation as well as cars, as well as bikes, making our cities more walkable, big passion of mine. So I really appreciate your testimony, and hopefully we will be working with you more on these issues.
Thank you, Representative Ream. Any further questions? Not seeing any. So I'm just want to thank you guys so much. I think this has been a really helpful, informative committee. It's given us a lot to kind of go back and think about. And, you know, I just keep encouraging members to contact their locals and figure out, you know, what kind of assistance and help that they really could use when it comes to getting some of this infrastructure money and making sure that all parts of our state are getting the resources that they need. And so, members, that concludes our hearing for today. Our next hearing will take place on January 25th at 8:30, and we will be in 10. Sorry to keep you guys going back and forth, but when we have remote testifiers, I want to make sure that we're able to get some of our greater Minnesota cities on board. And, you know, with the track record we've had so far, I'm glad everybody was able to get to committee without icy roads or snow. So I just really want to thank you all for engaging. And with that, this committee meeting is adjourned.